Hello and welcome to another episode of PhD Divinem Beyond the Lab. We are Martina,
Chiara,
Nicolò,
Alessandro,
Maddalena,
Simona,
and Caterina.
And in today's episode, we are going to talk about tumor biology and microenvironment. Cancer is able to evade the immune system and quickly adapt to chemotherapy. This happens through various mechanisms that lead resistance to cell death. But why is it so difficult to find a suitable therapies against tumors? Cancer cells often have the same characteristics as normal cells, and each tumor is different from another, highlighting a great heterogeneity. In recent years, it has become clear how important are mitochondria and the tumor microenvironment are for cancer development and resistance.
So, what areas could we explore to defeat cancer?
So, studying metabolism and the tumor microenvironment are the new areas of interest. Many of the features that distinguish cancer cells from normal cells, such as uncontrolled growth, increased resistance to cell death, increased mobility, and altered regulation of cell fate, are determined by metabolic processes, in which mitochondria play the main role.
Would you mind explaining what mitochondria are for people in the audience who might not know?
So, yes, of course. Mitochondria are the energy powerhouses of the cells. They are highly complex organelles that play a crucial role in energy metabolism, apoptotic processes, and important cell signaling pathways. Cancer cells have a dysregulated mitochondrial metabolism. For example, they have an increased amino acid and lipid metabolism, and they switch their nutrient and oxygen consumption rate depending on the tumor stage.
You said that cancer cells are more resistant to cell death. Can you explain why is that?
So, to become resistant to cell death, cancer cells tend to overexpress or downregulate proteins involved in these processes. In my lab, for example, we focus on IF1, which is the natural inhibitor of the ATP synthase. The latter is the protein that produces the energetic coin for our organism. Recently, IF1 has been found to be overexpressed in many tumor types, and as a pro-oncogenic protein, protects cancer cells from apoptosis. So, targeting mitochondria could be a novel therapeutic approach for treating cancer cells. So, it's obvious that tumor cells use different strategies to survive and grow, but the cancer cells do not play alone. The tumor microenvironment also plays a crucial role in tumor growth and survival. And now I hand it over to Chiara to continue.
I would like to deepen the constituents of tumor microenvironment and their relation with tumor cells, discussing the role of adipocytes, which are stromal cells, and the main constituents of adipose tissue. Besides their known function as energy storage, they also act as regulators of metabolism. Indeed, tumor cells may exploit adipocytes to obtain more metabolic substrates, such as glucose, lactate, glutamine, and lipids. These high energy compounds can be used by cancer cells, boosting their metabolism and thus increasing energy production. Besides, adipocytes release inflammatory molecules in the tumor microenvironment, known as adipokines. This crosstalk between tumor cells and adipocytes has been proven to induce cancer cell proliferation and metastasis, and it is also the focus of our research in the lab. We in fact try to understand how the presence of an excessive amount of adipocytes near the tumor cells can influence the progression of neuroendocrine tumors, which are rare tumors, and if the common treatments reduce their efficacy in that condition. We sort of recreate in vitro what happens in an obese individual, in a simplified way, obviously.
So, if I understood well, it seems to me that there is a great relation between weight control and tumor prevention. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It has been proven in a significant number of studies that obesity is related to an increasing risk of developing certain types of cancer, such as pancreatic, colorectal, gastric, breast, and ovarian. This happens because obesity is characterized by low-grade inflammation, hormonal alterations, insulin resistance, and these events can actually induce tumorigenesis and cancer progression.
Does an overabundance of adipocytes somehow influence the efficacy of antitumor therapies?
Obese cancer-associated adipocytes can affect the efficacy of anti-cancer treatments by preventing tumor drug penetration, altering tumor metabolism, increasing abnormal vascularization, impairing immune cell function, and supporting tumor cell survival. All of these lead to drug resistance in tumor cells. Therefore, a novel promising strategy to develop innovative cancer therapies is blocking these mechanisms of resistance. Indeed, clinical practice, the patients with obesity have been shown to exhibit a poor outcome after traditional treatments, including radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery for cancer. Now I hand it over to Nicolò, who will discuss more about lipid metabolism.
Hello. Yeah, lipids are connected to a lot of other facets of the TMA or tumor microenvironment as well. So, for example, my lab is very involved in studying extracellular acidosis, and we have noticed it has a significant effect on lipid metabolism, at least in osteosarcoma, which is the type of cancer we most study. Extracellular acidosis is a common feature of the tumor microenvironment in solid tumors, and it generates due to the fact that cancer cells tend to have an altered metabolism. In general, they tend to stop doing normal phosphorylation and instead switch to anaerobic respiration. This produces a lot of protons, and these protons have to be pumped out of the cell, otherwise the cell would die, and in turn acidify the entire microenvironment around it. And the tumor microenvironment has an important effect of it on chemioresistance, and it can also basically put the cell in a quiescent state and increase its aggressiveness. But to connect back to the previous topic, acidosis also tends to make the cells generate a huge amount of lipids. And although people often think of lipids of just like energetic molecules or structural at best, there are a lot of lipids that function as signaling molecules too. My lab is studying sphingolipids, which play a very, very important role in cancer. Some tend to be anti-cancer, like ceramide, while some have very powerful pro-cancer effect, like sphingosine-1-phosphate. In fact, my project is currently on sphingosine-1-phosphate, which not only has like five intermembrane receptors with which it can interact to generate a plethora of effects, but it can also be synthesized directly in the nucleus and there have epigenetic effects too. For those who are uninitiated, epigenetics are basically genetic changes that don't directly impact the genetic sequence of the cell, but they are still inheritable. So we're usually talking of nucleotide modification or even histone modifications. And these changes that the sphingosine-1-phosphate can enact are very, very increased in acidosis, according to our data. And that means acidosis can have a very, very important effect on the lipid metabolism of the cell. And in case the listeners are interested, what it specifically does in the nucleus, this sphingosine-1-phosphate, is that it can inhibit histone deacetylases. Histone deacetylases are enzymes that can deacetylate histones, which simply means taking away an acetyl group from the histone. And the deacetylated histones tend to make the DNA around them coil and therefore make it not available for transcription and then translation. This means the gene has less expression than normal. So sphingosine 1 phosphate, by inhibiting the histone deacetylases, makes the DNA more available and increases the expression of certain genes. One of these, which is very important at least for my lab, because it's very important in osteosarcoma, is FOS, which codifies for the oncogene CFOS. And CFOS expression is extremely important in osteosarcoma differentiation. In fact, it has been seen that the only, just the overexpression of CFOS is enough to generate osteosarcoma. The augmented lipid metabolism can have pretty important consequences.
And so, how do the cells avoid lipotoxicity if they accumulate so many lipids?
They do it by simply isolating them from the rest of the cellular environment. So instead of having them free in the cytoplasm, which would definitely kill the cell, they create these lipid droplets. They look just like little bubbles inside the cells and can be seen in microscopy with enough resolution. And the lipids are just segregated inside the lipid droplets and taken out when there is a need for them.
And how do you replicate acidosis for in vitro experiments?
We have a specific medium called RPMI. So usually when you make a medium for cell culture, you either add or you already have inside the liquid medium some bicarbonate to buffer the pH. This means that the pH of the medium will be more resistant to changes. RPMI is a medium that we can leave unbuffered, and therefore, since there is nothing to buffer the pH of the cells, the cells can decide their own pH and just adjust it based on their metabolism.
Are there any treatments that target sphingosine 1 phosphate since it's so important?
Yeah, there are several. Some are more specific than others, while others are much more general. From the general side, we have FTY720, also called fingolimod, which has been used a lot in later years. That is an inhibitor that basically targets the entire sphingosine 1 phosphate pathway. It inhibits all of its receptors, and it inhibits both the enzymes that can synthesize it. There is also dimethyl sphingosine, which is a step in between for specificity, and it only inhibits the synthesis of S1P. And then for the very, very specific one, there is, let me see if I remember it, ABC294640, which only inhibits the enzyme that synthesizes S1P in the nucleus. We're actually using that for our current study because we want to see specifically the nuclear effect of S1P and not all the others. All of these have been tested in vivo, not on patients, but on mice, and they have shown that they can reduce tumor aggressiveness by a ton, and in some cases, even tumor size. And I'd say I can now give the voice to Simona.
I would like to talk about microRNAs, which are the focus of my PhD project, and highlight the crucial role they play within tumor cells and in shaping the tumor microenvironment, influencing tumor metabolism and aggressiveness. To begin, miRNAs are post-transcriptional regulators, consisting of small non-coding RNA molecules that modulate the gene expression. Many miRNAs not only directly affect the metabolism of tumor cells, but also act on the surrounding microenvironment, contributing to the complexity and dynamic nature of tumors. One interesting example is the miR-21. This oncogenic miRNA is frequently overexpressed in many types of cancer and regulates not only intracellular metabolism, such as glycolysis, but also the communication between tumor cells and their macroenvironment. Recent studies have shown that the miR-21 promotes the secretion of pro-inflammatory cytokines and growth factors, such as the TGF-beta, which drive the transformation of fibroblasts into cancer-associated fibroblasts. These, in turn, remodel the extracellular matrix and increase the availability of nutrients, thereby creating a favorable environment for tumor progression. Another example is the miR-210, known as the hypoxia miRNA. This miRNA is highly upregulated under low oxygen condition, which is a common characteristic of the tumor microenvironment. The miR-210 not only helps tumor cells adapt to metabolic stress, but also alters the behavior of infiltrating immune cells. Specifically, it reduces the activity of cytotoxic T cells, fostering an immunosuppressive microenvironment that protects the tumor from immune elimination. Additionally, many tumors release the miRNA through extracellular vesicles, such as the exosome, which acts as molecular messengers capable of reshaping the microenvironment at distance. For instance, the miRNA contained within exosome can influence the behavior of endothelial cells, stimulating angiogenesis, or modifying macrophages in the macroenvironment, transforming them into tumor-associated macrophages that support the tumor growth and resistance to the therapies. A striking case is the miR-375, which, although typically is a tumor suppressor miRNA, it can negatively modulate the local immune response when released in altered concentration through exosome, further enabling a permissive microenvironment. So we can say that it's clear that miRNAs not only orchestrate tumor metabolism and growth within the cells, but also act systemically, transforming the tumor microenvironment into a cancer relay.
How can we leverage this knowledge in cancer management?
Oh yes, miRNAs are particularly important because they serve a dual purpose. First of all, they can have a diagnostic value since they can function as circulating biomarkers, allowing non-invasive blood monitoring for early diagnosis or treatment or response evaluation. Second of all, they represent a promising therapeutic target. So, for example, inhibiting oncogenic miRNAs such as the miRNA-21 could not only directly target tumor cells, but also neutralize fibroblasts and the immune cells supporting them, disrupting the pathological communication between tumor cells and the microenvironment.
So, this looks like a very effective tool, but also very challenging and difficult at the same time. So, what would you say the main challenges or limitations of this tool are?
Yeah, clearly much work is still needed to make these therapies more specific and safer. There are many uncertainties, such as how to modulate miRNAs without compromising the healthy macroenvironment, or how to exploit their actions as therapeutic target selectively. So these questions guide our research toward novel and innovative approaches. And with that, I now hand the floor over to Alessandro.
Thank you. So in my lab, we also investigate tumor microenvironment, and we do that in relation mainly to bone tissue, bone tumors. And in my area of expertise, I have covered also cancer-associated fibroblasts. Just to give some context, cancer-associated fibroblasts, or also CAFs for short, are stromal cells, mainly derived from resident fibroblasts, that are somehow reprogrammed, we could say, to favor tumor cells in many different ways. The history of their study is actually pretty fascinating because they've been known for many decades, but cyclically there's always something new about them. For instance, every tumor has its own CAF signature, if you want, that basically gives the tumor specific features that can be beneficial or not to the disease. And this signature, mind you, is patient-specific in most cases. And that's basically one of the reasons why they're so difficult to study. So we will say at the end of everything, every tumor microenvironment is composed of a vast plethora of different subsets of cancer-associated fibroblasts, and many of which are still to, are still to be discovered. The most important one is certainly the myofibroblastic one that was first discovered and most studied as well. And interestingly, this subset has many things in common with normal fibroblasts that activate during wound healing, with the difference that they never stop trying to heal that wound. They're found in close in close proximity to the tumor, and they also remodel ECM to a vast degree, with different effect according to the ACM that they produce. So just to give you an example, literature has shown that collagen deposition myofibroblastic cuffs tends to form some sort of peritumular capsule that ultimately has the effect of basically trapping the tumor and prevent metastasis formation, but favors chemoresistance. In other patients, instead, fibronectin deposition brings to the exact opposite. Altogether, they basically form tracks that cancer cells tend to follow in order to migrate away from the primary tumor, with the consequence that we can all, you see, deduct, basically.
And Alessandro, what about other cuff subpopulations?
Yeah, as I said, there's many different subpopulations. The main three, I will say, are the myofibroblastic one that I've just talked about. Then we have a very prevalent population of inflammatory cancer-associated fibroblasts. And the most recent one is the antigen-presenting one. Basically, it exerts a phenotype of antigen presentation, which is useful for the tumor because it actually traps T lymphocytes in an inactive phenotype most of the way. So tumor is not harmed by our immunity system, basically. These are the main ones, but in these subsets, there's also many different sub-subsets, if you want. So there's actually tens or even hundreds of different subpopulations, actually.
How are they studied if there are so many subpopulations?
Well, yeah, the main thing is that they are very heterogeneous and very plastic cells. So it's quite different. It's quite difficult to pin them down and actually be able to study them. The most challenging thing is that they actually are not so different from normal fibroblasts or from other cellular populations. And the most difficult thing in order to study them is to find the right marker to pin down the right subpopulation. So all you have to do is basically find the right cocktail of markers that you need to study the precise subpopulation that you want.
Before you said that CAFs are mainly derived from fibroblasts, are there other progenitors as well?
Well, yes. The main progenitor is fibroblasts, as I said, but depending on the tissue, there can be other progenitors as well. One of the main progenitors outside of fibroblasts is MSCs, mesenchymal stem cells, but also pericytes and adipocytes, if I remember well. So yeah, there's many, depending on the tissue. And with that, I give the word to Maddalena.
Thank you, Alessandro. The lab I'm working in has been deeply committed to studying the tumor microenvironment, an intricate ecosystem that surrounds tumor cells. Recent research has highlighted its immunosuppressive nature. It acts like a shield blocking T cells, our immune system's warriors, from doing their job. This not only slows down the immune response, but also promotes tumor growth, making tumors more resistant to therapies. Tumors can be broadly divided into two categories: hot tumors, which are filled with immune cells, and cold tumors, which are devoid of them. Interestingly, in hot tumors, special structures called tertiary lymphoid structures, or TLS, often form. These resemble tiny lymph nodes and contain T cells, B cells, and other immune cells, along with blood vessels. Their presence signals an active immune response and has been strongly linked to better outcomes and improved responses to immunotherapy. In our lab, we've taken this knowledge a step further by focusing on the outliers. These are patients whose tumors, despite containing TLS and immune cells, do not respond to immunotherapy.
Why do these patients fail to respond, and what can we learn from them?
Oh, this is a good question. This is particularly relevant in the case of head and neck cancers, which are my area of research. Unlike melanoma and other solid tumors that often respond well to immunotherapy, head and neck cancers tend to be much less responsive. Our work has identified a subset of patients with TLS-rich tumors who still show poor outcomes. This population seems to mirror the characteristics of head and neck cancers, and we are working to unravel the mechanisms behind their resistance.
So this research seems very translational. So can it actually make a good difference in patient outcome or their life?
So by studying these resistant cases, we aim to identify new therapeutic targets and strategies to enhance immunotherapy response, especially in cancers like head and neck tumors. Eventually, we hope this research will bring us closer to ensuring that more patients can benefit from these groundbreaking treatments.
And so, what's next for cancer research?
Unlocking the secrets of the tumor microenvironment and its outliers could revolutionize our approach to cancer therapy. Now I hand it over to Caterina.
Thank you, Maddalena. Well, my project aims to characterize the molecular profile and tumor immune microenvironment in a large series of patients with endometrial carcinoma, with particular focus on NSMP subtype. In order to achieve a more accurate biomolecular classification of this disease, specifically, I'm working on teaching an image recognition software to identify the different components of the tumor microenvironment and their spatial distribution within the tumor.
Why will you focus mainly on the NSMP subgroup?
Well, the non-specific molecular profile NSMP subgroup is the largest and has the most variable prognosis. Therefore, efforts are being made to stratify these patients from both a prognostic and predictive perspective.
That seems very interesting, even if I'm not very tech-savvy myself. So what are the challenges, you would say, of this research project?
Well, one of the main challenges of this project is certainly obtaining all the archived histological material from patients affected by these neoplasms who were treated at the Sant' Ursula Hospital over the past 10 years. Subsequently, I will review all the cases, collecting all relevant histological parameters, and I will select the most representative tumor areas on which to perform image analysis. The other challenge will be training the image analysis software, which is an aspect I have never dealt with before and represents a completely new challenge for me and my training.
Okay, thank you, Caterina. And with that, I'd say we wrap up today's episode. Thank you for joining us on this journey, and stay tuned for more episodes of PhD BNM. Until next time, and everyone say bye.
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 Bye. Bye.
Ciao.